I want to invite you to reach for your handout. I know this, that sermons are supposed to be inspiring. They're supposed to allow you to think the noblest thoughts you can think, for to think of God is as high as your thoughts can go. And yet, I'm going to ask you to sink into the gutter with me for just a moment. Just one moment. I want you to, for just a moment, think of the most vile, disgusting, unthinkably foul thing you can think of. Something that you wouldn't even dream of touching for fear that you might be contaminated or that you'd retch in disgust. So I'm asking you to think of the opposite of kittens and puppies and rainbows and flowers, although those probably just popped in your head. I want you to think of something that doesn't evoke compassion, that just evokes disgust. When I think of things for me, I think of lice. You know, we've had it in our family before. It's something that you're contaminated. It spreads. You got to clean everything. I think of vomit. You know, I just hate to clean that up. I do my best. I think of broccoli, those little things at the top. I don't know how anyone eats that. I think of a dirty toilet in an old gas station that hasn't been cleaned for weeks. We've all been there before, and you just don't even know if you want to even use it. Those kind of things that bring disgust. And when you have whatever it is that disgusts you most in your mind, magnify your disgust by about 1,000 and add a sense of religious justification to your disgust, that it is holy and godly and righteous to be disgusted by this thing. And when you get there, you're coming close to the Hebrew perspective on leprosy. Leprosy was something that evoked great fear in Hebrew people. They despised it. They didn't want to be around it. And for good reason. They were afraid that they might be contaminated if they were to be even loosely associated with a leper. That's why the lepers, once leprosy was diagnosed in an individual, was socially ostracized. They were placed outside the camp according to Torah, according to the Hebrew law. Placed outside the camp. They weren't allowed, once leprosy was diagnosed, to associate with friends or family. They weren't allowed to be involved in anything in a community. They'd have to be in their own quarantine colonies. Well, apparently there was a colony of lepers on the outskirts of the town that Jesus enters in our story here. You notice in the first verse, he's in the region between Samaria and Galilee. So we're on the border between Samaria and Galilee somewhere. Jesus enters a town, and these lepers, 10 of them we're told, speak to Jesus, and they're following the law. Look at verse 12. As he entered a village, 10 lepers approached him, keeping their distance. So they're keeping their distance. They're supposed to keep afar, keep to themselves. And they call out saying, "Jesus, Master, have mercy on us," which is not exactly what they're supposed to be saying. According to Torah, their first word should be, "Unclean, unclean." Unclean, pointing to the fact that they were physically leprous, but even more, that they were ritually unclean and unable to enter into any kind of Jewish worship. They couldn't approach the temple. They couldn't approach a priest. They are unclean, which you can imagine if you're a leper, ostracized by your family, sent and quarantined in a community, to consider that you have to constantly shout out unclean would give you this sense that even God's disgusted by me. Even God doesn't want me to be in the vicinity of anything divine or anything having to do with God. And so they're not shouting unclean, unclean. I assume that that's what they're doing, but they're also adding this, "Jesus, Master, have mercy on us." And when you say mercy, in that day, it usually meant you're begging for alms. You're looking for a handout. You're looking for some money. That's all you can do. You can't work a job. And so they could be simply begging for alms, but they also may have heard about Jesus and his healing ministry. And they may be looking for more than that. Whatever it is they're looking for, I love that in verse 14, Jesus sees them. When he saw them. Now, it'd be much easier to not see them, just like it's easy to pass on by what disgusts us, what should be quarantined, what should keep to itself. But Jesus, instead of ignoring them, instantly sees them, and he says something curious to us as modern day readers, but it made all kinds of sense to the lepers. He said in verse 14, "Go and show yourselves to the priest." What that means is that the lepers are Jews, because otherwise they couldn't approach a Jewish priest. What it also means is Jesus is promising them that they'll be healed. Because the only reason a leper could ever return to a priest was if the leper discerned that they were being healed, that they were being saved from their leprosy, that that was going away, and they'd approach a priest in order the priest could go through some rituals and sacrifices and declare them clean again. Make it so that they could re-enter Jewish community, re-enter their homes, go back to public worship. It took the priest to establish that they could cross the boundary back into society again. And so you only went to the priest if you were being healed. Well, they trust that Jesus is promising them that they're going to be healed. And so in our last sentence in the first paragraph, as they went, they were made clean. And it's hard to imagine. But you know, they're making their way, trusting that Jesus' word is true, and as they're moving along, they realize that a healing is happening. That Jesus' words are true. That there's a good reason to go to the priest. They're going to be able to re-enter back into society. So that the story could end there, and it's a wonderful story of Jesus' healing, but it doesn't end there. There's a second half to the story, because as they're returning and being healed, one of them does something different than the other nine. Verse 15, then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice, he prostrated himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him. So he does all the things that we really respect. He goes back to Jesus. He recognizes that Jesus is the source of his healing. He praises God with a loud voice. He falls in worship and says, thank you, Jesus, for this healing. And as we're hearing this story, and as the first readers were hearing this read out loud, at this point, we have a huge positive impression of this guy. We're all thinking, as listeners, this is a good guy. I mean, this guy, out of the 10, he's the only one that goes back and shows appreciation. He's the only one that comes back and praises God. And with that positive impression, we then get from Luke his Twilight Zone twist. Because at this point, most readers would be unhappy. Verse 16, he prostrated himself at Jesus' feet. He thanked him. Oh, by the way, he was a Samaritan. And now we realize, oh my gosh, this guy not only had one strike against him being a leper, he has two strikes. He's a Samaritan. He's not only a leper, a social outcast, he's a religious heretic and a half-breed. He's the people that Jews most despise. The Samaritans are most like the Jews, but the Samaritans don't worship at the temple. They only accept a small portion of the Torah. They don't have the same religion. They don't have the same values. They're of a different race. They're considered half-breeds. They are foreigners in every way to a Jewish community, and you wonder, how is it that this Samaritan ended up mixed up with at least nine other Jews? And I have a reason for that, that I think shared misery creates compatriots where you'd never expect it. I mean, when you're socially outcast, you stop worrying about Jewish and Samaritan distinctives because you're dealing with a common problem. All of a sudden, your enemy's your friend because all of your friends have abandoned you. And so this Samaritan had been in that colony with them, but he is not a Jew. And what Luke does at this point is he presents this leper, a Samaritan, a foreigner, as the unlikely hero of the story. And he does it through the words that Jesus is about to say to him. Verse 17, then Jesus asked, were not 10 made clean, but the other nine, where are they? Was none of them found to return and give praise to God except for this foreigner? In some way, the way the story is told, there is something that the other nine are missing out on. There is something about the other nine's behavior that Jesus is at least challenging. And that's where it is up to us to figure out what's going on here. Now, there's a number of possible reasons that the other nine just continue on to the priest. One of the reasons could be that they want to get to the priest, they want to get their stuff taken care of, and they know that they don't want to really be too closely connected to Jesus. They want to keep their distance because they know he's a marked man. He's created a lot of enemies at this point. He's on his way to Jerusalem. Guess what happens at Jerusalem? Betrayal and crucifixion. They know that it may be best to keep your distance from this man. It could also just simply be that they're eager to return to life as they once knew it. They're eager to get back to family and friends. They're so excited about being healed that they forget the source of their healing and they just move right back into life. That could possibly be. But here is what I think is the most likely reason. And think about this. The other nine had more to gain by continuing on to the priest. because that was the next vital step for their reentry into Jewish community. This is a Samaritan. He has no such incentive. The Jewish priests have nothing to offer him. They probably won't even see him. He's a Samaritan. They have nothing to offer him because he doesn't need their rituals and sacrifices to be reintroduced into Hebrew community because he's not one of them. And all of a sudden you begin to see, if that's the case, and I think it is, it's his outsider status that allows him to view Jesus differently and rightly. It's his being an outsider that allows him to understand God has done something incredible through this person, Jesus. And so I must return and I must show my gratitude and I must thank God. It's not like the nine were any less cured, but the story implies that they're less grateful. They represent, I think, according to the story, the many that Jesus helps that establish no bond with Jesus, that don't go back and thank, that don't praise, that don't continue on with Jesus. They're the ones that benefit, but then they move on with their lives. Jesus says to this man something that is so amazing in verse 19 as our story ends. He says, "Get up and go on your way. Your faith has made you well," which is a way of saying, you know, all 10 were healed, but you're made whole. You are receiving the fullness of God's salvation. You are the one through your praise and thanksgiving that evidences you have faith in the first place and you trust me, and you're the one that is bonding to me and benefiting more than any of the others. They're all blessed by it. They're all healed. But you're the one that is connecting to me in the way that I desire. Sharon Dowd writes this, "The fault of the nine is not that they do not see God at work in their healing, but they do not see God at work in and through Jesus. All 10 lepers are cleansed, but only the Samaritan is also made whole spiritually, saved by coming to relationship with the God of Israel through Jesus Christ." And that's why Jesus, affirming his faith, "Your faith has made you well," gives the final command, "Get up and go on your way." Now, go back to your life. Go back sharing this good news. Go back sharing that gratitude, continuing in praise. Move forward in life knowing that you've not just been healed, but you've been made whole. Make something of it. Share that with others. Now that's our story, and I want to do something that I normally do on Wednesday nights and give three reflections, three things I think we can learn from this story. And one of the first ones, and perhaps the most important one, is this mercy that Jesus shows to outsiders. This guy, the one leper, has two strikes, not one against him. All 10 had the strike of being a leper, but it's this Samaritan that has the second strike of being a Samaritan, a people that evoked disgust in Jews. Obviously, you could be disgusted by leprosy. There was the fear of contamination, but there was an ethnic hostility, a boundary between Jew and Samaritan. But of course, Jesus, particularly in Luke, but in all four Gospels, loves to step over boundaries. He loves to just brush them right out of the way. Geographical, religious, social boundaries. That's why he's crucified in the end. He is scandalous to those who want to keep the boundary markers thick and make sure you know there's them and there's us. There's Jew and there's Samaritan. There's saved and there's not. People who want to keep those boundaries thick are always scandalized by Jesus' amazing ability to just step right over boundaries and show mercy, as in this case, to the Samaritan, to the outsider, to the foreigner. Now, we have a lot of boundaries in our world that we're afraid to cross, and sometimes we scandalize people for attempting to cross them. A perfect example of that happened this week. You're probably familiar with it. At our Packers-Cowboys game last Sunday, you've probably all seen this because this made news, and rightly so. At our Packers and Cowboys game, there was a couple of pictures shown of George Bush, our former president, sitting beside Ellen, and I guess that would have been scandalous enough, but the real scandal was they both seemed to be enjoying themselves. They were sharing a laugh between the two and having fun. And unfortunately, some of Ellen's followers, and I'm sure some of George's as well, but some of Ellen's followers were scandalized, not only that she would associate with a conservative president, with her being a Hollywood liberal, as she self-admittedly confesses, but they were saddened that they were laughing together and enjoying each other's presence. So thanks be to God, may God bless her. Ellen, on her show the next day, gave a wonderful one-minute speech, and if you get a chance, you can YouTube it, where she essentially says, you know, I'm a Hollywood liberal. George is a conservative politician. I think that some of you think we shouldn't get along, but the fact is, we had a good time together, and you know, I believe that we're to be kind to people. And when I say people, I don't mean people just like us. I mean people that aren't like us. I mean people that you wouldn't normally show kindness to. When I say be kind to everyone, just like when Jesus says it, that means everyone, no exceptions. And thank God she said that. But some were surprised that Ellen would be the one saying that. I can tell you, I was not surprised at all, and I'll tell you why. At our summer UCC Synod, our General Synod that happens every 2 years, it's a national convention, the most rigorous debate occurred around a resolution. At these synods, you do boring stuff. You sit around and talk about resolutions and decide whether to pass them. I literally feel like ending my life every time I'm at one of these things. But this one made me want to go on. Because we had some robust discussion about Resolution 5 or 8. I forget what it was now, but it's one of those resolutions. And the resolution was put forth by a liberal group that the Faithful and Welcoming group in the UCC, they're a conservative group within our UCC. It's a big tent. We have all kinds. This more conservative group, which is considered to be not welcoming or not inclusive of, that's the better word, of homosexuals, wanted to have some space, and they always have had space at these conventions where they can share their material, advertise their material. I've talked to them, and if you talk to them, you realize it's not that they're hostile to inclusion of homosexuals, they're just not sure. And so they are welcoming. They say that. They're faithful and welcoming. They just don't know whether they want to be open and affirming, which is the other side, where you just completely include. So they're part of the UCC, and the resolution, 5 or 8, was this. Faithful and Welcoming should no longer have any shared space at any of our synods. They should not be given any voice, and they should not be given any space to advertise. That's the resolution. Well, here's what's interesting. There were a few from the queer community that got up and spoke, because everyone has a chance to speak, and said, we're threatened by this, they threaten us, they don't want to include us. But the vast majority of the people defending the Faithful and Welcoming group, saying they ought to have voice and they ought to have space, guess what? The vast majority were LGBTQ people. The vast majority were from the queer community saying this at the microphone. We know what it's like to be excluded. We know what it's like to have your voice quenched and not have people listen. We know what it's like to be right where this group is right now. And even whether we agree with them or not, they should have space. They should be able to have a voice. They shouldn't be silenced because they're different. Now imagine that. It's the outsider. It's the foreigner, it's the stranger, it's the one that's not in the majority that looks at the situation and sees it most clearly. You know why? They've been on the other side of the tracks. That's why I'm not surprised it was Ellen calling the bluff of some of those who were saying you shouldn't be kind to someone different than you. Ellen has known the unkindness from people who think she's different. And she's decided and chosen she's going to show kindness, she's going to show grace. Well, if the marginalized and the outsider matters to Jesus, they should matter to us. And I think the questions this demands of us, who are for the most part in the majority, is who are we sometimes pushing out of the village? Who are the lepers and Samaritans and the foreigners of the 21st century that we sometimes refuse to show mercy to, we refuse to include, we refuse to cross the border to meet? That's the first point, Jesus' mercy to outsiders. The second point that is very important here, because it's amazing. If you look at the end of the passage, your faith has made you well. How does Jesus know this man has faith? And you know what the answer is? Jesus knows he has faith because at the opening of this paragraph, he returns back to Jesus, he praises God, and he falls prostrate before Jesus and thanks him. That response of gratitude and praise is enough for Jesus to know this guy has faith. He has salvation. He knows wholeness. Alan Culpepper writes, "Gratitude may be the purest measure of our character and spiritual condition. The absence of the ability to be grateful reveals self-centeredness, or the attitude that I deserve more than I ever get, so I don't need to be grateful. The presence of gratitude shows that no matter what's going on, there's always something and some reason to give thanks. For the air I breathe, for the life I have, for the clothes I have, for the home I have, for the friends I have." You could go on and on. There's always some reason to be grateful. And the moment we lose that, we lose access to what Jesus perceives as faith. He sees faith in the prayer of gratitude, which is why I love this short quote by Meister Eckhart. I love that name, by the way, Meister Eckhart. I've named many of my Dungeons & Dragons characters Meister Eckhart. Meister Eckhart, a mystic in the 14th century, wrote this. Listen to this. "If the only prayer you ever said in your life was thank you, that would be enough. If the only prayer you ever said in your life was thank you, that would be enough." I think that that's a valid point when you realize all Jesus heard was thank you. And he said, that's enough. Your faith has made you well. Which leads me to my third and final point. One of the reasons we worship is because we are the 10th leper turning back. There are words of worship in verse 15 and 16. Doxa, which is praise. Eucharisto, which is thanksgiving. All of these words speak of what we try to do every Sunday and every Wednesday, anytime we meet, for that matter. Martin Luther, in the 1500s, was asked, "Martin, what's the nature of true worship?" And his answer was this, and it's the reason I titled this message that. The nature of true worship, according to Martin Luther, is the 10th leper turning back. Why would Martin say that? Because the 10th leper goes out of his way, changes course, expresses thanksgiving, and recognizes Jesus. It is that worship which is the right and proper response to the presence of Jesus. And the reason he puts it this way, the 10th leper turning back, is he wants to suggest the majority of this world will experience the blessings of God. They'll experience the blessings of Christ, but they'll just go on with their life. They won't turn back. They won't express gratitude. They won't praise. They won't enter into a consistent, faithful relationship with Jesus. They'll enjoy the benefits, but they'll move right on with their life. What characterizes the faithful is that they're the 10th leper turning back. They recognize Jesus. They want to continually express gratitude. They want to praise God in light of what Jesus has done in their lives. And in that action, you realize that that's really at the heartbeat of worship. Keep in mind, the 10 lepers sang in concert like a choir, "Lord, have mercy on us," as the whole world does. "God, have mercy. Lord, have mercy." The whole choir. But only one, singing a solo, comes back and says, "Praise God. Thank you, Jesus." When we worship, we return like the one leper to praise and to give God thanks. And then we get up after we've turned. And like Jesus says, we get up and go on our way. Because we've been made whole through our praise, through our gratitude, through our worship. And we leave hearing the words of Jesus say to us, "Your faith has made you well." Would you pray with me?